The Cave of the Ancients by Tuesday Love Sang Rampa, read to you by Blue Friend, September 2016. Chapter 3. The Lamasery of the State Oracle was small, compact, and very secluded. Few small cellas played with carefree abandon. No groups of trappers lounged indolently in the sun-drenched courtyard, whiling away the noonday hour in idle chatter. Old men, old lamas too, were in the majority here. Aged men, white of hair and bent under the weight of years, they went slowly about their business. This was the home of the seers. To the aged lamas in general, and to the oracle himself, was entrusted the task of prophecy, of divination. No uninvited visitor entered here. No stray traveler called in search of food or rest. This was a place feared by many and forbidden to all except those specifically invited. My guide, the Lama Mingyar Dondup, was the exception. At any time, he could enter and find that he was indeed a welcome visitor. A gracious grove of trees gave the lamasery privacy from prying eyes. Strong stone walls gave the buildings protection from the overcurious, if there should be any who would risk the wrath of the powerful Oracle Lama for idle curiosity. Carefully kept rooms were set aside for His Holiness, the Inmost One, who so frequently visited this temple of knowledge. The air was quiet. The general impression was of quietude, of men placidly going about their important business. Nor was there opportunity for brawls, for noisy intruders. The place was patrolled by the mighty men of Cam, the huge men, many of them over 7 feet tall, and none of them weighing less than 250 pounds, who were employed throughout Tibet as monk police, charged with the task of keeping order in communities of sometimes thousands of monks. The monk police strode the grounds constantly alert, constantly on guard. Carrying mighty staves, they were indeed a frightening sight to those with guilty consciences. A monk's robe does not necessarily cover a religious man. There are wrongdoers and lazy men in all communities, so the men of Cam were busy. The lamastic buildings, too, were in keeping with their intended purpose. No high buildings here, no long-notched poles to scale. This was for aged men, men who had lost the elasticity of youth, men whose bones were frail. The corridors were easy of access, and those of greatest age lived upon the ground floor. The state oracle himself also lived upon the ground floor, at the side of the temple of divination. Around him lodged the oldest man, the most learned, and the senior monk police of the men of Cam. "We will go to see the oracle," Lobsang said, my guide. He has expressed great interest in you and is prepared to give you much of his time. The invitation, or command, filled me with the greatest gloom. Any visit to an astrologer or seer in the past had been productive of bad news, more suffering, more confirmations of hardships to come. Usually, too, I had to wear my best robe and sit like a stuffed duck while listening to some prosy old man bleating out a string of platitudes which I would rather not hear. I looked up suspiciously. The Lama was struggling to conceal a smile as he gazed down at me. Obviously, I thought dourly, he has been reading my mind. He broke into a laugh as he said, "Go as you are. The oracle is not at all swayed by the state of one's robes. He knows more about you than you know yourself." My gloom deepened. What was I going to hear next, I wondered. We walked down the corridor and went out into the inner courtyard. I glanced at the looming mountain ranges, feeling like one going to an execution. A scowling police monk approached, looking to me almost like a mountain on the move. Recognizing my guide, he broke into welcoming smiles and bowed deeply. "Prostrations at the lotus feet, Holy Lama," he said. "Honor me by permitting me to lead you to His Reverence, the State Oracle." He fell into step beside us, and I felt sure that the ground trembled to his ponderous tread. Two lamas stood beside the door. Lamas, not ordinary monk guards. At our approach, they stood aside that we might enter. "The Holy One awaits you," said one, smiling upon my guide. "He is looking forward to your visit, Lord Mingyar," said the other. We walked in and found ourselves to be in a somewhat dimly lighted room. For some seconds I could distinguish very little, indeed. My eyes had been dazzled by the bright sunlight in the courtyard. Gradually, as my vision returned to normal, I perceived a bare room with but two tapestries upon the walls, and a small incense burner which stood smoking in a corner. In the center of the room, upon a plain cushion, sat a quite young man. He looked thin and frail, and I was amazed indeed when I realized that this was the state oracle of Tibet. His eyes protruded somewhat and stared at me and through me. I had the impression that he was seeing my soul and not my earthly body. My guide, the Lama Mingyar Dondup, and I prostrated ourselves in traditional and prescribed greeting. Then we rose to our feet and stood waiting. At last, when the silence was becoming decidedly uncomfortable, the oracle spoke. "Welcome, Lord Mingyar. Welcome, Lobsang," he said. His voice was somewhat high in pitch and was not at all strong. It gave the impression of coming from a great distance. For a few moments, my guide and the oracle discussed matters of common interest. Then The lama, Mingyur donned up, bowed, turned, and left the room. The oracle sat looking at me, and at last said, "Bring a cushion and sit by me, Lobsang." I reached for one of the padded squares resting against a far wall and placed it so that I could sit before him. For a time he gazed at me in a somewhat moody silence, but at long last, when I was becoming uncomfortable beneath his scrutiny, he spoke. "So you are Tuesday Lobsang Rampa," he said. "We knew each other well in another phase of existence. Now, by order of the Inmost One, I have to tell you of hardships to come, difficulties to overcome." "Oh, sir," I exclaimed, "I must have done terrible things in past lives to have to suffer thus in this. My karma, my predestined fate, seems to be harder than anyone else's." "Not so," he replied. "It is a very common mistake for people to think that because they have hardships in this life, they are necessarily suffering for sins of past lives. If you heat metal in a furnace, do you do so because the metal has erred and must be punished? Or do you do it in order to improve the qualities of the material?" He looked hard at me and said, "However, your guide, the Lama Mingyur Dondup, will discuss that with you. I have to tell you only of the future." The oracle touched a silver bell, and an attendant entered silently. Padding across to us, he placed a very low table between the state oracle and me, and upon the table he placed an ornate silver bowl, lined, apparently, with the form of porcelain. Within the bowl glowed charcoal embers, which flared bright red as the monk attendant swung it in the air before placing it in front of the oracle. With a muttered word, the import of which was lost upon me, he placed a richly carved wooden box to the right of the bowl, and departed as silently as he had come. I sat still, ill at ease, wondering why all this had to happen to me. Everyone was telling me what a hard life I was going to have. They seemed to delight in it. Hardship was hardship, even though, apparently, I was not having to pay for the sins of some past life. Slowly, the oracle reached forward and opened the box. With a small gold spoon, he ladled out a fine powder, which he sprinkled on the glowing embers. The room filled with a fine blue haze. I felt my senses reel, and my sight grew dim. From a measureless distance away, I seemed to hear the tolling of a great bell. Closer came the sound, and its intensity grew and grew until I felt my head would split. My sight cleared, and I watched intently as a column of smoke rose endlessly from the bowl. Within the smoke, I saw movement which came closer and engulfed me so that I was part of it. From somewhere beyond my comprehension, the voice of the state oracle reached me, droning on and on. but I had no need of his voice. I was seeing the future, seeing it as vividly as he. Within a point of time, I stood apart and watched the events of my life, real before me, as if pictured upon an ever-moving film. My early childhood, events in my life, the fierceness of my father, all were portrayed before me. Once again I sat before the great lamasery of Jacques-Pori. Once again I felt the hard rocks of the Iron Mountain as the wind whipped me from the lamasery roof to fling me with bone-breaking force down the mountainside. The smoke swirled and the pictures, what we term the Akashic Record, moved on. I saw again my initiation, secret ceremonies wreathed in smoke as I was not then initiated. On the pictures I saw myself setting out on the long, lonely trail to Chongqing in China. A strange machine twisted and tossed in the air, soaring and falling above the steep cliffs of Chongqing, and I was at the controls. Later I saw fleets of such machines, with the rising sun of Japan flaunted on their wings. From the machines fell black blobs, which rushed to the earth to erupt into flame and smoke. Wrecked bodies hurled heavenwards, and for a time the skies rained blood and human fragments. I felt sick at heart and dazed as the pictures moved and showed me myself being tortured by the Japanese. I saw my life, saw the hardships, felt the bitterness. But the greatest sorrow of all was the treachery and evil of some people of the Western world, who, I saw, were bent on destroying work for good, for the sole reason that they were jealous. The pictures moved on and on, and I saw the probable course of my life before I lived it. As I well knew, probabilities can be most accurately forecast. Only the minor details are sometimes different. One's astrological configurations set the limit of what one can be and can endure, just as the governor of an engine can set its minimum and maximum speeds. A hard life for me, all right, I thought. Then I jumped so hard that I almost left the cushion. A hand was laid upon my shoulder. As I turned, I saw this face of the state oracle now sitting behind me. His look was of utter compassion, of sorrow for the difficult way ahead. "You are very psychic, Lobsang," he said. "I normally have to tell these pictures to onlookers. The inmost one, as one would expect, is quite correct." "All I want," I replied, "is to stay here in peace. Why should I want to go to the Western world, where they should so ardently preach religion and try to cut one's throat behind one's back?" "There is a task, my friend," said the oracle, "which must be accomplished. You can do it in spite of all the oppositions. Hence the special and difficult training which you are undergoing. It made me feel most glum, all this talk about hardships and tasks. All I wanted was peace and quiet and some harmless amusement now and then. Now, said the oracle, it is time for you to return to your guide, for he has much to tell you, and he is expecting you. I rose to my feet and bowed before turning and leaving the room. Outside, the huge monk policeman was waiting to lead me to the Lama Mingyar Dondab. Together we walked side by side, and I thought of a picture book I had seen wherein an elephant and an ant walked a jungle path side by side. Well, Lobsang, said the Lama as I entered his room, I hope you are not too depressed at all that you have seen. He smiled at me and motioned for me to sit. Food for the body first, Lobsang, and then food for the soul, he exclaimed laughingly as he rang his silver bell for the monk attendant to bring our tea. Evidently, I had arrived just in time. Lamasery rules stated that one must not look about while one was eating. One's eyes should not stray, and full attention should be given to the voice of the reader. Here, in the Lama Mingyar Dondab's room, there was no reader perched high above us, reading aloud from the sacred books in order to keep our thoughts from such common things as food. Nor were there any stern proctors ready to jump at us for the slightest infraction of the rules. I gazed out the window at the Himalayas stretching endlessly before me, thinking that soon the time would come when I should gaze upon them no more. I had received glimpses into the future, my future, and I dreaded the things which I had not seen clearly, but which had been partly veiled in smoke. Lobsang, said my guide, you have seen much, but much more has remained hidden. If you feel that you cannot face the planned future, then we will accept the fact, though sadly, and you may remain in Tibet. Sir, I replied, you once told me that the man who sets out upon one of life's paths, falters and turns back, is no man. I will go ahead, in spite of knowing the difficulties before me. He smiled and nodded his approval. As I expected, he said, you will succeed in the end. Sir, I asked, why do not people come to this world with the knowledge of what they have been in past lives, and what they are supposed to do in this life? Why must there be what you term hidden knowledge? Why cannot we all know everything? The Lama Mingyar Dondab raised his eyebrows and laughed. You certainly want to know a lot, he said. Your memory is failing, too. Quite recently I told you that we do not normally remember our past lives, as to do so would be to increase our load upon this world. As we say, the wheel of life revolves, bringing riches to one and poverty to another. The beggar of today is the prince of tomorrow. If we do not know of our past lives, we all start out afresh, without trying to trade on what we were in our last incarnation. But, I asked, what about the hidden knowledge? If all people had that knowledge, everyone would be better, would advance more quickly. My guide smiled down at me. It's not so simple as that, he replied. For a moment he sat in silence, and then he spoke again. There are powers within us, within the control of our overself, immeasurably greater than anything that man has been able to make in the material, the physical world. Western man in particular would abuse such powers as we can command, for all that Western man cares about is money. Western man has but two questions. Can you prove it? And what do I get out of it? He laughed quite boyishly and said, I always feel most abused when I think of the vast array of mechanisms and apparatus which man uses to send a wireless message across the oceans. Wireless is the last term they should use, for the apparatus consists of miles and miles of wire. But here in Tibet, our trained lamas send telepathic messages with no apparatus at all. We go into the astral and travel through space and time, visiting other parts of the world and other worlds. We can levitate, lift immense loads by the application of powers not generally known. Not all men are pure, Lobsang, nor does a monk's robe always cover a holy man. There can be an evil man in a lamasery, just as there can be a saint in prison. I looked at him in some puzzlement. But if all men had this knowledge, surely they would all be good, I asked. The Lama looked at me sorrowfully as he replied, We may be safeguarded. Many men, particularly those of the West, think only of money and of power over others. As has been foretold by the Oracle and others, this, our land, will later be invaded and physically conquered by a strange cult, a cult which has no thought for the common man, but exists solely in order to bolster up the power of dictators, dictators who will enslave half the world. There have been high lamas who have been tortured to death by the Russians because the lamas would not divulge forbidden knowledge. The average man, Lobsang, who suddenly had access to forbidden knowledge, would react like this. First, he would be fearful of the power now within his grasp. Then it would occur to him that he had the means of making himself rich beyond his wildest dreams. He would experiment, and money would come to him. With increasing money and power, he would desire yet more money and power. A millionaire is never satisfied with a million, but he wants many millions more. It is said that in the unevolved, absolute power corrupts. The hidden knowledge gives absolute power. A great light dawned upon me. I knew how Tibet could be saved. Jumping up excitedly, I exclaimed, Then Tibet is saved! The hidden knowledge will save us from invasion. my guide looked upon me with compassion. "No, Lobsang," he replied sadly, "we do not use the powers for things like that. Tibet will be persecuted, almost annihilated, but in the years to come, she will rise again and become greater, purer. The country will be purified of dross in the furnace of war, just as, later, the whole world will be." He gave me a sideways glance. "There has to be wars, you know, Lobsang," he said quietly. "If there were no wars, the population of the world would become too great. If there were not wars, there would be plagues. Wars and sickness regulate the population of the world and provide opportunities for people on the earth and on other worlds to do good to others. There will always be wars until the population of the world can be controlled in some other way." The gongs were summoning us to the evening service. My guide, the Lama Mingyar Dandap, rose to his feet. "Come along, Lobsang," he said. "We are guests here and must show respect for our hosts by attending the service." We walked out of the room and went into the courtyard. The gongs were calling insistently, being sounded longer than would have been the case at Shakpuri. We made our surprisingly slow way to the temple. I wondered at our slowness. Then I looked around, and I saw a very aged man and the infirm hobbling across the courtyard in our footsteps. My guide whispered to me, "It would be a courtesy, Lobsang, if you went across and sat with those chelas." Nodding, I made my way around the inner walls of the temple until I came to where the chelas of the state oracle Lamasari were sitting. They eyed me with curiosity as I sat down to one side of them. Almost imperceptibly, when the proctors were not looking, they edged forward until they surrounded me. "Where do you come from?" asked one boy, one who seemed to be the leader. "Shakpuri," I replied in a whisper. "You the fellow sent by the inmost one?" whispered another. "Yes," I whispered back. "I have been to see the oracle. He told me..." "Silence!" roared a fierce voice just behind me. "Not another sound out of you boys." I saw the big man move away. "Gah," said a boy, "don't take any notice of him. His bark is worse than his bite." Just then, the state oracle and an abbot appeared through a small door at the side, and the service commenced. Soon we were streaming out into the open again. With the others, I went to the kitchen to have my leather barley bag refilled and to get tea. There was no opportunity to talk. Monks of all degrees were standing about, having a last-minute discussion before retiring for the night. I made my way to the room allotted to me, rolled myself in my robe, and laid down to sleep. Sleep did not come quickly, though. I gazed out at the purple darkness, pinpointed by the golden-flamed butter lamps. Far away, the eternal Himalayas stretched, rock fingers skywards as if in supplication to the gods of the world. Vivid white shafts of moonlight flash through mountain crevices to disappear and flash again as the moon climbed higher. There was no breeze tonight. The prayer flags hung listlessly from their poles. The merest trace of cloud floated indolently above the city of Lhasa. I turned over and fell into a dreamless sleep. In the very early hours of the morning, I awakened with a start of fright. I had overslept and would be late for the early service. Jumping to my feet, I hastily shrugged into my robe and bolted for the door. Racing down the deserted corridor, I dashed out into the courtyard, straight into the arms of one of the men of Cam. "Where are you going?" he whispered fiercely as he held me in an iron grip. "Too early morning service," I replied. "I must have overslept." He laughed and released me. "Oh, you are a visitor. There is no early service here. Go back and sleep again." "No early service?" I cried. "Why, everyone has early service." The monk policeman must have been in a good mood, for he answered me civilly. "We have old men here, and some who are infirm. For that reason, we dispense with the early service. Go and rest a while in peace." He patted me on the head, gently for him, like a thunderclap for me, and pushed me back into the corridor. Turning, he resumed his pacing of the courtyard, his ponderous footsteps going bonk, bonk, with the heavy stave going thunk, thunk, as the butt thudded into the ground at every other step. I raced back along the corridor, and in minutes I was sound asleep again. Later in the day, I was presented to the abbot and two of the senior lamas. They questioned me intently, asking me questions about my home life, what I remembered of my past lives, my relationship with my guide, the Lama Mingyur Dondup. Finally, the three rose totteringly to their feet and filed towards the door. "Come," said the last one, crooking a finger in my direction. Dumbfounded, walking as one in a daze, I followed meekly behind. They wended a slow way out of the door and shuffled lethargically along the corridor. I followed, almost tripping over my feet in an effort to go slowly enough. We crawled on, past open rooms where trappas and chelas alike looked up in curiosity at our slow passing. I felt my cheeks burn with embarrassment at being on the tail of this procession. At its head, the abbot shuffling along with the aid of two sticks. Next came two old lamas who were so decrepit and withered that they could scarcely keep up with the abbot, and I, bringing up the rear, could hardly go slow enough. At long last, or it seemed long last to me, we reached a small doorway set in a far wall. We stopped while the abbot fumbled with the key and mumbled beneath his breath. One of the lamas stepped forward to assist him, and eventually a door was pushed open with the squeal of protesting hinges. The abbot entered, followed by first one lama and then the other. No one said anything to me, so I went in as well. An old lama pushed the door shut behind me. Before me, there was a fairly long table laden with old and dust-covered objects. Old robes, ancient prayer wheels, old bowls and assorted strings of prayer beads. Scattered on the table were a few charm boxes and various other objects which I could not, at first glance, identify. Come here, my boy, commanded the abbot. I moved reluctantly toward him, and he grasped my left arm with his bony hand. I felt as if in the clutch of a skeleton. Which, if any of these objects and articles, were in your possession during a past life? He led me the length of the table, then turned me about and said, if you believe that any article was yours, pick it or them out and bring it or them to me. He sat down heavily and appeared to take no more interest in my activities. The two lamas sat with him, and no word was uttered. Well, I thought to myself, if the three old men want to play it this way, all right, I will play it their way. Psychometry is, of course, the simplest thing of all to do. I walked slowly along with my left hand extended, palm down, over the various articles. At certain objects I experienced a form of itch in the center of my palm, and a slight shiver or tremor thrilled along my arm. I picked out a prayer wheel, an old battered bowl, and a string of beads. Then I repeated my journey by the side of the long table. Only one more article caused my palm to itch and my arm to tingle, an old tattered robe in the last stages of decay. The saffron robe of a high official, the color almost bleached out by age, the material rotten and powdery to the touch. Gingerly I picked it up, half afraid that it would disintegrate between my cautious hands. Carefully I carried it to the old abbot, deposited it at his feet, and returned for the prayer wheel, the battered bowl, and the string of beads. Without a word, the abbot and the two lamas examined the articles and compared certain signs or secret markings with those in an old black book which the abbot produced. For a time they sat facing each other, heads a nod on withered necks, ancient brains almost creaking with the effort to think. Mumbled the abbot, wheezing like an overworked yak. It is he indeed. A remarkable performance. Go to your guide, the Lama Mingyar Dondop, my boy, and tell him that we should be honored by his presence. You, my boy, need not return. I turned and raced from the room, glad to be free from those living mummies whose desiccated remoteness was so far removed from the warm humanity of the Lama Mingyar Dondop. Scurrying around a corner, I came to a full stop, inches from my guide. He laughed at me and said, "Oh, don't look so startled. I received the message also." Giving me a friendly pat on the back, he hastened on toward the room containing the abbot and the two old lamas. I wandered out into the courtyard and idly kicked a stone or two. "You the fellow whose incarnation is being recognized?" asked a voice behind me. I turned to see a Chela regarding me intently. "I don't know what they're doing," I replied. "All I know is that I have been dragged around the corridors so that I could pick out some of my old things. Anyone could do that." The boy laughed good-naturedly. "You Chakpori men know your stuff," he said, "or you would not be in that lamasery. I heard it said that you were someone big in a past life. You must have been for the oracle himself to devote half a day to you." He shrugged his shoulders in mock horror and remarked, "You'd better look out. Before you know what's happening, they'll have recognized you and make you an abbot, and then you won't be able to play with the other men at Chakpori any longer." From the door at the far end of the courtyard appeared the form of my guide. Rapidly he strode towards us. The Chela, with whom I'd been talking, bowed low in humble salutation. The Lama smiled upon him and spoke kindly as always. "We must be on our way, Lobsang," said the Lama Mingyar Dondop to me. "Soon night will be upon us, and we do not want to ride through the darkness." Together we walked to the stables, where a monk groom was waiting with our horses. Reluctantly I mounted and followed my guide onto the path through the willow trees. We jogged along in silence. I could never converse intelligently on horseback, as the whole of my energies was devoted to staying on. To my astonishment, we did not turn off at Chakpori, but wended our way on to the Patala. Slowly the horses climbed the road of steps. Beneath us the valley was already fading into the shadows of the night. Gladly I dismounted and hurried into the now familiar Patala in search of food. My guide was waiting for me when I went to my room after supper. "Come in with me, Lobsang," he called. I went in and at his bidding seated myself. "Well," he said, "I expect you're wondering what it is all about." "Oh, I expect to be recognized as an incarnation," I replied airily. "One of the men and I were discussing it at the state oracle lamasery when you called me away." "Well, that is very nice for you," said the Lama Mingyar Dondop. "Now we have to take some time and discuss things. You need not attend service tonight. Sit more comfortably and listen, and do not keep interrupting." "Most come to this world in order to learn things," commenced my guide. Others come in order that they may assist those in need, or to complete some special, highly important task. He looked sharply at me to make sure I was following, then continued. Many religions preach about a hell, the place of punishment or expiation for one's sins. Hell is here, on this world. Our real life is on the other world. Here we come to learn to pay for mistakes made in previous lives, or, as I said, to attempt the accomplishment of some highly important task. You are here to do a task in connection with the human aura. Your tools will be an exceptionally sensitive psychic perception, a greatly intensified ability to see the human aura, and all the knowledge that we can give you concerning all the occult arts. The Inmost One has decreed that every possible means be used to increase your abilities and talents. Direct teaching, actual experiences, hypnotism, we are going to use them all in order that we may get the most knowledge into you in the shortest time. Hell, it is all right, I exclaimed gloomily. The Lama laughed at my expression. But this hell is merely the stepping stone to a far better life, he replied. Here we're able to get rid of some of the baser faults. Here, in a few years of earth life, we shed faults which may have plagued us in the other world for countless spans of time. The whole life of this world is but the twinkling of an eye to that of the other world. Most people in the West, he went on, think that when one dies, one sits on a cloud and plays a harp. Others think that when one leaves this world for the next one, they exist in the mystical state of nothingness and like it. He laughed and continued, if we could only get them to realize that the life after death is more real than anything on earth. Everything on this world consists of vibrations, the whole world's vibrations, and everything within the world may be likened to an octave on a musical scale. When we pass to the other side of death, the octave is raised further up the scale. My guide stopped, seized my hand, and rapped my knuckles on the floor. That, Lobsang, he said, is stone, the vibration which we term stone. Again he took my hand and rubbed my fingers on my robe. That, he exclaimed, is the vibration which indicates wool. If we move everything up the scale of vibrations, we still maintain the relative degrees of hardness and softness. So, in the life after death, the real life, we can possess things just as we do on this world. Do you follow that clearly? He asked. Obviously, it was clear. I had known things like that for a very long time. The Lama broke into my thoughts. Yes, I am aware that all this is common knowledge here, But if we vocalize these unspoken thoughts, we shall make it clearer in your mind. Later, he said, you will journey to the land of the Western world. There you will meet many difficulties through Western religions. He smiled somewhat wryly and remarked, the Christians call us heathens. In their Bible it is written that Christ wandered in the wilderness. In our records it is revealed that Christ wandered throughout India, studying Indian religions, and then he came to Lhasa and studied at the Jokhang under our foremost priests of that time. Christ formulated a good religion, but the Christianity practiced today is not the religion that Christ produced. My guide looked at me somewhat severely and said, I know you're a little bored by this, thinking I am talking for the sake of words, but I have traveled throughout the Western world, and I have a duty to warn you of what you will experience. I can do that best by telling you of their religions, for I know you have an eidetic memory. I had the grace to blush. I had been thinking too many words. Outside in the corridors, monks were shush-shushing along toward the temple to the evening service. On the roof above, trumpeters looked out across the valley and sounded the last notes of the dying day. Here in front of me, my guide, the Lama Mingyur Dondup, continued his talk. In the early days of life upon earth, said the Lama, people were first in little groups, very small tribes. There were no laws, no codes of behavior. Strength was the only law. A stronger and fiercer tribe made war upon those weaker. In course of time, a stronger and wiser man arose. He realized that his tribe would be the strongest if it were organized. He founded a religion and a code of behavior. Be fruitful and multiply, he commanded, knowing that the more babies were born, the stronger would his tribe grow. Honor thy father and mother, he ordered, knowing that if he gave parents authority over their children, he would have authority over the parents. Knowing, too, that if he could persuade children to feel indebted to their parents, discipline would be easier to enforce. Thou shalt not commit adultery, thundered the prophet of that time. His real command was that the tribe should not be adulterated with the blood of a member of another tribe, for in such cases there are divided loyalties. In course of time, the priests found that there were some who did not always obey religious teachings. After much thought, much discussion, those priests worked out a scheme of reward and punishment. Heaven, paradise, Valhalla, term it what you will, for those who obeyed the priests. Hellfire and damnation with everlasting tortures for those who disobeyed. Then you are opposed to the organized religions of the West, sir? I asked. No, most certainly not, replied my guide. There are many who feel lost unless they can feel or imagine an all-seeing Father peering down at them, with a recording angel ready to note any good deeds as well as bad? We are God to the microscopic creatures who inhabit our bodies, and the even smaller creatures that inhabit His molecules. As for prayer, Lobsang, do you often listen to the prayers of the creatures existing on your molecules? But you said that prayer was effective, I responded with some astonishment. Yes, Lobsang, prayer is very effective, if we pray to our own over-self, to the real part of us in another world, the part which controls our puppet strings. Prayer is very effective if we obey the simple natural rules which make it so. He smiled at me as he said, Man is a mere speck in a troubled world. Man is only comfortable when feeling safe in some form of mother's embrace. For those in the West, untrained in the art of dying, the last thought, the last cry is mother. A man who is unsure of himself while trying to give an appearance of confidence, will suck a cigar or cigarette just as a baby will suck a dummy. Psychologists agree that the smoking habit is merely a reversion to the traits of early childhood, where a baby drew nourishment and confidence from his mother. Religion is a comforter. Knowledge of the truth of life and death is of even greater comfort. We are like water when on earth, like steam when we pass over in death, and we condense again to water when we are reborn to this world once more. Sir, I exclaimed, do you think that children should not honor their parents? My guide looked at me in some surprise. Good gracious, Lobsang, of course children should pay respect to their parents, so long as the parents merit it. Over-dominant parents should not be permitted to ruin their children, though, and an adult child certainly has first responsibility to his or her wife or husband. Parents should not be permitted to tyrannize and dictate to their adult offspring. To allow parents to act thus is to harm the parents as well as oneself. It makes a debt which the parents must pay in some other life. I thought of my parents, my stern and harsh father, a father who had never been a father to me. My mother, whose main thought was of the social life. Then I thought of the Lama Mingyar Dandap, who was more than a mother and a father to me, the only person who had shown me kindness and love at all times. A monk messenger hastened in and bowed deeply. Honorable Lord Mingyar, he said respectfully, I am commanded to convey to you the respects and salutations of the Inmost One, and ask you to be good enough to go to him. May I lead you to him, sir? My guide rose to his feet and accompanied the messenger. I walked out and climbed to the roof of the patella. Slightly higher, the medical lamasari of Chakpuri loomed out of the night. By my side a prayer flag flapped weakly against its mast. Standing in a nearby window, I saw an old monk busily twirling his prayer wheel, its clack-clack, a loud sound in the silence of the night. The stars stretched overhead in endless procession, and I wondered, did we look like that to some other creature somewhere? End of chapter 3.